I'd like to tell you a story this morning about a famous rabbi, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. Rabbi Yehuda, like Rabban Gamliel, about whom we learned last night, lived in the land of Israel, in his case, at the end of the second century. He was an influential Jewish leader. He was selected to be Nasi, the patriarch, with many administrative and legislative and judicial responsibilities. He edited the Mishnah, a comprehensive Jewish legal code. He was also beloved and looked up to by his fellow rabbis and scholars. This is the story about the day he died. The Talmud tells it this way. Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi was very, very ill. It was clear to him and to those around him that he was dying. He called for his sons, and when they arrived, he gave them instructions. "Take care," he said, "that you show respect to your mother after I'm gone. Keep the home fires burning. And let my two attendants, Yosef of Haifa and Shimon of Ephrat, who attended on me during my lifetime, attend to me afterwards as well." He called on the sages of Israel to come forward, and he ordered them, "Don't carry out public mourning for me in the small villages. I don't want to put people out. You may mourn for me in the towns, but for no longer than 30 days. His disciples gathered in the courtyard just outside his home to pray for his recovery. Now, Rabbi Yehuda had a dear, devoted aide, a woman of great sensitivity and compassion. She went out onto the roof of Rabbi Yehuda's house. In the land of Israel, this was not uncommon. Roofs were, and still are in many cases, flat, and people would often go out onto them to catch a cool breeze. She looked down and saw the disciples praying that Rabbi Yehuda remain among the living. She looked up and she saw the angels in heaven beckoning Rabbi Yehuda to join them. She joined her prayers with those of the disciples, praying that they would defeat the angels above and that Rabbi Yehuda would recover. But then, the Talmud tells us, Rabbi Yehuda's handmaid looked closely at Rabbi Yehuda and noticed how much pain and suffering he was enduring. He was suffering from some sort of intestinal ailment. Today we might call it colitis. And frequently he had to get up and go to the bathroom. Now in those days it was customary to wear tefillin, boxes that contained texts from the Torah that we attached to our arm and to our head with straps. It was customary to wear tefillin all day long, but you would never bring them into a bathroom. And so, whenever Rabbi Yehuda needed to go, he would get up, unwind the tefillin straps laboriously, go to the bathroom, come back, put the tefillin straps back on, and get back into bed, exhausted. And within an hour, he'd be doing the same thing all over again. Rabbi Yehuda's handmaid saw all this and was torn. On the one hand, she continued to identify with Rabbi Yehuda's students. Like them, she wanted Rabbi Yehuda to remain among the living. On the other hand, she saw how much he was suffering, and she observed the angels above beckoning to him. She saw that Rabbi Yehuda was hovering between this world and the next, between the terrestrial angels, his students, and the celestial angels above. They were evenly matched. "What," she thought to herself, "does Rabbi Yehuda want?" My guess is that this is not an unfamiliar image to many of us. So many of us have been there, haven't we? In the presence of a relative or a friend who is gravely ill and close to death. In some cases, medical treatment needs time to do its magic. In other cases, time makes clear just where things are heading. What is often the case, unfortunately, is that patients are incapacitated and their family members really don't have a clue how they would like to be taken care of, how they'd like to live out their remaining days. What's more, often patients and members of their families haven't internalized a simple biological and religious truth, namely that we are all mortal. I am sure that I am not the only one in this room who spent time this summer reading Atul Gawande's Being Mortal. Being mortal, he writes, is about the struggle to cope with the constraints of our biology. Dr. Gawande shares with us in his clear, beautiful prose just what is at stake in thinking and talking about these issues. He tells us how crucial it is to think ahead of time about what's important to us, how we'd like to live our lives as our capacity diminishes. How, he asks, can we keep life worth living when we're weak and frail and can't fend for ourselves anymore? And who will decide and how when to shift from pushing against limits to acceptance, to making the best of a situation? Jewish tradition has a lot to teach us in this regard. Probably the best known Jewish teaching in this area is that life is of infinite value. And preserving life is a great mitzvah. So important, it takes precedence over almost all other mitzvot. It's not surprising that Jews have pursued the medical arts with such energy and commitment. There may be other reasons, but surely a primary one is that our tradition has long highly valued healing. We must not stand idly by the blood of a neighbor. So says Leviticus. If there's something we can do, we must. Restoring a person's health is like restoring anything else that a person has lost. It's a mitzvah. But there are other considerations and concerns. Sometimes life-saving efforts can bring with them terrible pain and suffering. What then? In our tradition, pain is not a value. Alleviating pain is. When a patient is suffering, it's the duty of those tending to him or to her, doctors, nurses, family members, to do what they can to reduce that suffering. Now, might that conflict with the goal of preserving and maintaining life? Possibly. What then? Clearly, treatment options raise all sorts of moral and religious issues. The last thing I want to do this morning is to suggest that there is a simple psak din, a simple Jewish legal ruling that answers all of our questions in each and every circumstance. That's not the case. Every situation needs to be examined carefully against the background of Jewish values and tradition. It's important to study what the Jewish tradition has to say about these matters and to get some rabbinic guidance. It's also important for us to think about and to talk about these matters with our loved ones ahead of time to try to clarify what we most value about life so that family members can act in our best interests, even when we are not able to communicate with those around us. Many of us may recall reading the columns of Ellen Goodman, a Boston-based writer who wrote for the Boston Globe for many, many years. A few years ago, Ellen Goodman got involved in a project called the Conversation Project. It's an effort to help people figure out how to have these conversations. It's all online at theconversationproject.org. And I encourage everyone to go there, to read what is written there, and then to set aside time to have those conversations that will help us and our loved ones live out our lives the way we and they would like to, even as our lives are drawing to a close. By the way, if you're wondering whether it's really necessary to be talking about this, consider the following statistics that are available at the Conversation Project's website. When asked whether talking with loved ones about end-of-life care is important, 90% say that it is. And yet, only 27% report having actually done it. When asked whether it's important to make your wishes known to your loved ones, 82% say yes, but only 23% have actually done so. So there are conversations to be had. Why aren't those conversations occurring? There's no better answer than to point to the title of Roz Chast's recently published memoir about helping her parents through the last few years of their lives. It's entitled, "Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant?" Who wants to talk about this? Most people do not look forward to having a discussion about how they want to live when their capacities are diminished. It just seems too depressing. We avoid it like the plague. As Woody Allen once put it, "I am not afraid of dying. I just don't want to be there when it happens." Why are we talking about this today of all days? Because this is the day when we think about what it means to be mortal. On this day, we simulate that passage from this world to the next that we usually try to avoid thinking about. We dress in white, we refrain from eating, we confess our sins, and we pray for forgiveness. What does the Machzor say about this? Well, there's that stark, eloquent, and frightening passage from the Unetane Tokef that we will shortly be reciting. And the poet, the author of that amazing prayer, gives us the message that Atul Gawande is trying to convey. Adam yisodo me'afar v'sofo li'afar. We come from dust, and we are heading toward dust. Mashul kecheres hanishbar, kechatsir yavesh uketzitz novel, kecel over uchenan kala, וכרוח נושבת וכאבק פורח וכחלום יעוף. We are like broken shards, dried up grass, faded flowers. We are like a fleeting shadow, a passing cloud, like a dream that slips away. In short, we are mortal. And there are implications of that. Yes, medical care can keep us alive and well, sometimes for a very long time. But eventually, it is powerless, entirely powerless. And that implies that we should be having conversations with those whom we love about what matters to us and how we want to live out our days. Recognizing that we are mortal has other implications as well. If the goal of medical care is to add years to our lives, the goal of being here, the goal of davening together, of learning what our tradition is all about, learning what it demands of us, and how to live full and fulfilled Jewish lives, the goal of all of that is, in Rabbi Sidney Greenberg's felicitous phrase, to add life to our years. So much of the urgency of this day derives from the realization that our lives are finite and short. As Rabbi Jonathan Sacks has put it, we have only one life to live, and however long it may seem, it is a mere microsecond in the history of the universe. Let's use that precious and fleeting gift well, to be good and to do good. Let me go back to that scene from 1800 years ago. There's Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, painfully taking his tefillin off and on again, in bed, in acute distress. And there are the celestial angels above, beckoning him to join them, angels below, the disciples in the courtyard, pulling him toward them. And there is Rabbi Yehuda's handmaid on the roof. She looks up at the heavens. She looks down at the disciples in the courtyard. And she looks at Rabbi Yehuda in pain, in distress. And she prays that the celestials this time will overcome the terrestrials. And then, the Talmud tells us, Rabbi Yehuda's maid continued to look upon this scene, and then she picked up a vase, a large earthenware vase, and tossed it off the roof. It fell to the courtyard and came crashing to the ground, startling the disciples. In shock, they ceased their praying for a moment to look at the scene. And at that very moment, the text tells us, Rabbi Yehuda's soul gently left his body. What did Rabbi Yehuda's handmaid do? In the words of the rabbis, she removed an impediment to his death. And why did she do this? Because, and this we have to assume, she knew Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi very, very well and his needs. And this handmaid goes down in Jewish history as a great friend and supporter of the rabbi. One more thing. The language that the Talmud uses to describe Rabbi Yehuda's death is instructive. The text does not say he died. Instead, it says, "Benach nafshei derabbi," and Rabbi Yehuda's soul rested. That image of the soul being at rest is a very powerful one in our tradition. It's an image picked up most recently by another Sacks, Oliver Sacks, in his final essay, in which he said, "And now, weak, short of breath, I find my thoughts drifting to the Sabbath, the day of rest, the seventh day of the week, and perhaps the seventh day of one's life as well, when one can feel that one's work is done, and one may, in good conscience, rest." Zochreinu l'chayim. That's what we say on this day. Remember us to life. What does it mean? We generally understand it to mean that we want God to remember to write us down in the proper scroll so that we'll live another year. But maybe sometimes it means something different. Maybe it can mean that we want those around us to remember how we would like to live within the constraints of our biology. To remember what is most important to us during the many days, weeks, months, and hopefully years that we have before us. For we want as many of our days as possible to be as full of life as possible. In order for that to happen, we have to talk about something that may not seem very pleasant, but which indeed can help us maintain and sustain that zikaron, that memory, when we most need it. Gemar chatima tova. May you and your loved ones be privileged to live in the coming year lives of health and happiness, meaning and purpose. Shana tova.